choice is in your hands.
Britain Designs.
Most of the countries in the world are outside the European Union, and they're doing very nicely, thank you.
Britain Designs.
I believe that Britain will be safer, stronger, and better off in a reformed European Union.
You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
This is the most profound political decision of my lifetime.
Britain Decides.
With Stephen Ritson.
It's time to speak up.
Hello and welcome to the third of our special programmes dedicated to the British referendum on membership of the European Union to take place on the 23rd of June. Looking at our website, talkradioeurope.com, I see your votes currently stand at Remain 62%, Leave 36.1% and Undecided at 1.8%. Remember, you can always go there and vote yourself if you haven't already done that. Later on in the programme today, I'll be joined by the Remain campaigner, the Labour frontbencher Chris Bryant, who's shadow leader of the House of Commons. He's also a former Europe minister. And Robert Oxley from Vote Leave, the officially designated campaign to get Britain out of the EU. And of course, if we want to hear from you, you can call us right now on 952 78 4000, tweet using the hashtag Britain Decides, email studio@talkradioeurope.com, or indeed leave a message on our forum at talkradioeurope.com. Today, I'd like to start by really asking how we got here, what brought us to this particular moment in time and this place. With us now is Dr. Moritz Pieper. He's lecturer in international relations at the University of Salford, and he joins us now from Salford in Greater Manchester. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your time. I wanted to start with a quote from Winston Churchill. It's an interesting one because he's been brought into this recently. Of course, there was the incident of the bust in the White House of Barack Obama. It was moved before he entered the Oval Office, I understand. But the Brexiteers, if you like, people wanting the UK to leave, saying this, the removal of that indicates that Obama's endorsement of the Stay campaign is part and parcel of his a degree of anti-British sentiment. That's one thing that was put out there just over a week ago. This quote from Winston Churchill, it's in 1946. He was giving a speech to the academic youth in Zurich in Switzerland, and he said, I quote Winston Churchill of all people, he said, "We must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way only will hundreds of millions of toilers be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living." Is that what the plan was from the beginning? We started with steel and coal and the European Economic Community, but has that been the plan all along to create a United States of Europe?
Well, it's an interesting quote because it has to be read in the context of its time. Churchill said this in 1946, so he postulated this idea of the United States of Europe after the devastating Second World War. So the idea was to create a sort of federal Europe to get at a moment of political unity as an escape from this devastating nationalism that we had seen. However, he was pretty content with the UK staying with its Commonwealth. But his idea was that a federal Europe could achieve peace and stability after this devastating war that we had seen. And then in practice, what we saw is, you rightly pointed out, the European Coal and Steel Community as a first sort of sector-specific example of cooperation, which then spilled over into other policy domains, and member states started pooling and sharing more and more resources and powers. So in practice, from a very practical cooperation, it spilled over into something bigger. We saw the single European market established. We saw ever more enlargements, and then even this European political cooperation coming into play as a first step in a first sort of foreign policy coordination that was then codified by subsequent treaties. And then with the Lisbon Treaty, eventually, we saw even the creation of a European External Action Service and the EU as a legal personality and as a foreign policy maker in its own right.
Well, just to briefly on that, as you mentioned, the Treaty of Lisbon, the Action Service, and the permanent, well, until the next time there's a vote, President of the European Council, we have a sort of European Minister of Foreign Affairs or representative. Some people, of course, on the outside are wary that looks as though it's a slippery slope towards creating a European superstate. Is it that, or is it a question of bureaucracy in the sense that before, when we had the rotating presidencies of the European Council, so each country was at 6 months at a time, so it'll take you 14 years to get round and be president once again, that wasn't perhaps practical. Henry Kissinger, you remember Henry Kissinger used to say, when I want to call Europe, who do I phone? Is it an attempt to get over that? Is it purely an administrative thing? Or are the people who want Britain to leave, and others who are more Eurosceptic within the rest of the EU, are they right that the Treaty of Lisbon is a hardly diluted version of that constitution, that's a slippery slope towards more federalism and more power, effectively, for Brussels and Strasbourg?
Well, you will never get at this level of federation that Winston Churchill outlined in this quote from 1946. You will never get this super state that the Leave campaigners so fear. The European Union will always remain a sort of hybrid organization combining elements of supranationalism, but also intergovernmental decision-making, of which, the Council is the utmost and the best example. You have the European External Action Service, which has been set up as a foreign policy machinery, but at the same time, the rotating presidency has not been abolished. There was a sort of transition period where you still have this rotating presidency, you have the EEAS, and you still have European Commission competences, like development aid, for example, that still resides with the Commission. So it is and will remain a hybrid organization that combines elements of all these. So this fear of a super state we will never see materialized in practice.
Let me ask you a question, so our listeners know, we did have a brief chat earlier, and it was a question of where are we going to head with the conversation. We'll see how it develops in the chat. So I'm putting you on the spot because I haven't, warned you about this beforehand. But one of the concerns that people on the Leave side have is that they often refer to the lack of democracy. Now, of course, we have the Council of Ministers and the European Council who represent the national governments. We have the European Parliament, which is directly voted by people. But the Commission, the civil service, the executive branch, the government, if you like, of the European Union, it's only the Commission that can actually propose a law. And when people talk about the lack of democracy, they point to that. I know they were voted for by people that we voted for, but it's rather difficult to get rid of commissioners or the commission or to disband it itself. Is there any attempt? Because that's one of the big things that people are wary of on the out camp. Are there any attempts to address that very issue, to change the nature? And if so, how would we do it, of the way the commission operates?
Well, it will always be a more indirect representation, if you will, that is born of the need to coordinate policies based on bureaucratic expertise. So you will never have directly elected commissioners. However, with the Lisbon Treaty, there has been. That was one issue, of course. The democratic deficit always looms large. And with the Lisbon Treaty, there was an attempt to also give the voice to a number of European citizens, if they collect a number of signatures to bring forward legislative initiatives and proposals. So the attempt has been there to democratize the European Union.
Do you happen to know, by any chance, how many times that's been used? Is it used quite a lot?
I don't know how many times it has been used. No, I mean it's sort of still in an experimental phase. The Lisbon Treaty was adopted in 2009, so already that's 7 years ago. But still in integration processes, that's still a fairly young phase.
Well, one of the areas of your expertise, of many areas, Russian foreign policy, Russian-Western relations, U.S. foreign policy, EU diplomacy. You've researched Chinese, Turkish foreign policies as well, our relationship with Iran. So the various interesting areas there. You were saying you had a look. There was a story in a tabloid newspaper in the UK, the Daily Express, and I think maybe a few other places, something along the lines of German and French plot to create a European army. Even more dramatic, it was a secret plot. I don't know if there's any other type of plot. But on the one hand, people can say, whoa, this looks, what is this? Is this an idea to abolish our national armies and have a pan-European one? But you had some involvement. You were looking at the Balkans War and Kosovo, perhaps other parts of the former Yugoslavia. When the European Union got involved there, when Milosevic was still in, it was a bit of a shambles. Obviously, it culminated in that horrendous disaster in Srebrenica, which was Dutch peacekeepers with blue helmets, UN peacekeepers. But the European Union, our soldiers, our forces individually, as nations, we're like running around like headless chickens, and eventually NATO had to step in. Is this something feasible? Is this really on the cards to have some sort of European army?
Well, first off, I think probably the Daily Telegraph is not the most reliable source when it comes to...
There is the Express, by the way, to be fair to the Telegraph.
Big Fed, okay, that's all right. All right. It's a curious formulation to say that this is a secret Franco-German plot when, in fact, you know, it was the Helsinki European Council in 1999 that for the first time formulated the ambition to develop a European security and defense policy, which then was later renamed the Common Security and Defense Policy in the Lisbon Treaty. But the idea on an EU level has been articulated, almost 20 years ago, including the UK, when the UK was a member. So the idea that this is a Franco-German plot is a curious way to put it. But
What about NATO? Both Germany and France are in NATO. What's wrong with NATO? That's basically all the good bits plus the United States, which, of course, has a considerable military might, the largest in the world. Why would we want to jeopardize that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point because the Americans were concerned of that. If you remember Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, referred to the European ambition to develop a defense policy as, you know, an unnecessary duplication. We do not want discrimination against non-EU NATO allies like Turkey, for example, and no decoupling of this so-called European security and defense policy from NATO. So the Americans were concerned of that. So a strong European foreign policy voice, so the understanding in Washington, might undermine U.S. foreign policy priorities. But you pointed out the Bosnian case earlier, which is very very relevant here, because in its early phases, the EU was completely incapable of formulating a common foreign and defense policy. We had this disaster in Bosnia that was resolved arguably only with the intervention of Bill Clinton's administration at the time, leading to the Dayton Agreement in 1995, EU military missions largely took over from NATO missions. So this is still very much the case that NATO is the predominant security provider in military matters.
Was there any psychology there? Of course, we bombed Belgrade, a European ancient and noble and sophisticated capital. We bombed Belgrade. That led to the downfall of Milosevic. Was there psychological reticence as well that one European country bombing another European country in this day and age?
I mean, if you go to Belgrade, and I've been to Belgrade last year, the sentiment very much is that this is remembered as a NATO bombing campaign. You know, the 1999 bombing of Belgrade, in which, incidentally, the Chinese embassy was hit. But this is remembered as a NATO.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is a NATO campaign, and it's not seen by Serbians nowadays as an EU military assault against their country.
Okay, because Serbia, as we know, would very much like to join the European Union. There are sticking points, of course, because it has very close historic relationship, ethnic and cultural, religious relationship with Russia, in Serbia. So that's, of course, is a bit of a sticking point in some ways. So you're saying that in Serbia, people say, right, when we were bombed, our capital city was bombed, this was NATO, so principally, psychologically, they think of it as it was a United States thing, not a European Union thing.
Yeah, yeah, this was the feeling that I got. But also, yeah, you pointed out Serbian membership ambitions, and certainly after the last Serbian elections, you know, the prime minister is articulating his goal of joining the European Union. You mentioned sticking points, that's true. Kosovo being one. But yeah, I mean, in Brussels, I don't think Serbian membership is on the table anytime soon. I mean, by some two critics, Serbia is always seen as a sort of Trojan horse for the Russians in the Balkans. And if it was to join the European Union, it would be, you know, the sort of inroad for the Russians into the European Union. A lot of that is conspiracy theory, but, you know, politically, that rhetoric still kind of lingers.
Just one thing before I let you go, because of sadly time flies, we can't stop the clocks. You spent a year in Moscow part of your work, and of course you were seeing the relationship between the European Union, Ukraine, and Russia from that particular perspective. There is a belief on the Russian side, of course, that all of this chaos that we have in Ukraine at the moment is down to the European Union pushing for Ukraine to break its traditional ties with Russia, let's say trade, let's forget the colonialism aspect of the Soviet Union for now, the trading relationship, and to come and join our camp instead. But we don't want them in NATO yet, because, of course, you know, it's Clause 5 or Article 5, where an attack on one is an attack on all of us, so that would be a bit dodgy in a country was in the middle of troubles. And we don't necessarily want to allow them to join the European Union at the moment. So what's going on there? Is it just a question of trying to spite Russia, get some trade, all the benefits for us, and none for Ukraine? What was going on there?
Well, on the side of the European Union, we have to remember that this idea of a European neighborhood program was born in 2004. Now, that program lumped together the southern and the eastern neighbors, including Ukraine. So it was seen as too broad of a brush. Then in 2008, we saw a more sophisticated, or the Europeans would see it as a more sophisticated attempt to refine this and to develop an Eastern partnership. And within that Eastern partnership, the idea was to achieve gradual regional integration by way of closer market harmonization. And that's when this association agreement was offered to Ukraine. So inter-regional trade projects, but in Russia, that was seen as an attempt to encroach upon this historic space, sphere of influence, as the Russians would have it. And then in Moscow, you had the formulation of the Eurasian Customs Union in 2010, and then a single economic space that had come into effect in 2012, consisting of Belarus, Russia, and Kazakhstan.
Okay, well, just briefly, why would that be the case more for the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, of course, and a few others there? It didn't seem so much that way, and yet with Ukraine, we seem to be having more of a problem. Is it perhaps because the populations of those former countries were very much in favour of distancing themselves from their Russian colonial past and joining the West, whereas Ukraine is much more of a split country on that issue?
It is split linguistically, ethnically, but the Baltics is a different matter for that matter, because I mean they are already EU member states having joined in 2004, but they have never been recognized as belonging to the post-Soviet space, so they have not been seen as
the CIS, post-Soviet the Community states. Of Independent States, yeah.
Yeah, they have never been part of that. Ukraine, this is where historical psychology comes into play. Ukraine has been so important in the formation of the modern Russian state. I mean, and Russians will tell you this dates back to the 10th century. You know, when you had the formation of the Kiev Rus as the first core of what would later evolve into modern Russia. So it has deep historical roots. So the Ukraine crisis became an actorness test for the European Union. In that perspective, where the pure technical trade side of things, as understood by the European Commission, spilled over into a much wider political debate about, are we talking about a wider Europe or about a greater Europe, where we can actually see interregional trade projects and the European Union's regional trade projects also maybe being combined with the single economic space that was formulated in Russia. So there have been attempts to not merge the two, but to see some kind of cooperation. But you know, the wider political dimension has to be understood for psychology on all sides.
Mm. Okay, well, obviously that that relationship ongoing. There are still some sanctions in place with Russia and mutually, of course, on EU products, particularly in agriculture and food. But we're going to have to leave that there for today. Dr. Moritz Pieper from the University of Salford, lecturer in international relations, among many other hats that you wear. Thanks so much for joining us here on Talk Radio Europe.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Britain Decides. TRE's coverage of Britain's EU referendum is hosted by Stephen Ridson, with expert guests, speakers from both sides, and your comments. Join in the debate on our online forum at talkradioeurope.com.
It's 12:32. Welcome back. We're joined now by Chris Bryant, who's Labour shadow leader of the House of Commons. He's a former Europe minister in the UK. And Robert Oxley, who's head of media for Vote Leave. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi there. I'm actually the last.
Hi, I should have said who's first. First of all, Chris Bryant, good afternoon to you.
Hi.
Hi. And Robert Oxley, good afternoon.
Hi.
Seem to be having a problem with Robert Oxley.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, hello. Right. Just wanted to establish for our listeners whose voice was whose. Today, we're doing a series of 10 programmes on the European debate, of course, the referendum up to the Wednesday the 22nd, the day before. Today, really, our starting point was how we got to this point. First to Chris Bryant. If it hadn't been for Nigel Farage, we wouldn't be having this referendum at all, would we?
So what?
Okay, all right. Were you?
I mean, I honestly don't think that voters care now. We're having a referendum. I'm more of a fan of parliamentary democracy than referendums, but we're having a referendum, and I think that for my own constituents, it's absolutely vital that we end up staying in. I start from a fundamental principle, which is that we achieve far more by our common endeavour than we do alone, and you just can't turn Britain into a hermetically sealed unit.
Right. It seems that economists over the past couple of weeks have been coming out on your side, if you like, in the Remain camp, and Nigel Farage has said that there should be more concentration on the immigration issue. The Remain side has been accused of scaremongering by the Leavers. Would you throw that accusation back?
Oh, look, I think there'll be all sorts of things said between now and referendum day. But in the end, I think that the Brexiteers, who incidentally can't agree with each other on what version of out they want for the UK, whether it's going to be a Swiss model or a Norwegian model or Icelandic or whatever, what they can't really tell us is how they would protect the strength of Britain into the future in terms of our international influence, or for that matter, in terms of jobs and our economy. And so the only thing that they want to bang on about is immigration, even though they fail to acknowledge that every single trade deal that has ever been done with the European Union has always said that you have to have free movement of labour.
That's not true.
That is true. It's simply the fact. Name one where it doesn't apply.
Canada has a free trade deal. Canada has a free trade deal with the EU. It does not involve free movement. It does not involve contributions into the EU budget. If you want to remain in the EEA or part of the single market, where you continue to pay money into the Brussels budget, where you continue to hand power over to EU courts, then yes, free movement has been one of those deals for the country. But look, you said that no deal with the EU has involved stopping free movement. That's just simply not true. And so look, I'd be very clear on this. You know, we did not want to hermetically seal off the UK, and I think that is disingenuous. What I believe is that Britain can have a better relationship with Europe as a whole. I don't think the EU is very good at the things that it does. And actually, in terms of what leave looks like, well, I believe it's a British option. I believe it's the fifth largest economy.
But you see, we don't get to write that.
I was polite enough to let you speak, so I think, yeah.
You weren't. You actually talked over me.
Only when you said something not true, I gave you a good chance.
So, yes, you did talk over me.
Excuse me, Robert Oxley, can I just talk over you? Just because you mentioned Canada there. The deal that took 7 years or so to negotiate, I understand the argument that were Britain alone, it wouldn't take so long. It's because you have to get 28 people to agree that it took so long. That's one argument. However, it doesn't involve the financial services sector. Now, that's about 12% of UK GDP. If Britain had a similar deal to Canada, that would be a disaster for the city, would it not?
Well, it's two things. Firstly, it doesn't involve passporting. It does involve services. There's a big distinction there, and I think, you know, we need to be accurate when we're talking about these types of deals. But then you have to look at a country like Switzerland, which doesn't have passporting. And even if you assume this worst-case assumption that we wouldn't get passporting, Switzerland, as a percentage of its exports, still sells more into the European Union than Britain does. The city is great because the city does what it does. It is full of talent. It is full of its position.
Look, the truth
go on,
is...
Chris. Chris, are we going to have a debate or are we just going to do this back and forth mocking?
Go on. I was just about to answer one of the points. You referred earlier to the that there will be a British solution. The thing is, that's not how it works. This is the fundamental lie at the heart of Leave, because we don't get to write the terms of it. There are 27 other countries, each of them with a veto. And I simply do not believe that those countries will go, yeah, you can just have whatever you want, Britain. You just go ahead and cherry pick. And the truth of the matter is, if we want to maintain our free trade agreement with the largest single market in Europe, in the world rather, then we will have to absorb, we would end up having to still contribute financially to the European Union. We would have to take on free movement. And even more importantly, just imagine you're a manufacturer of children's toys. You would have to abide by every single rule that was written by the European Union for those toys that you wanted to sell into Europe, and you wouldn't even be able to sit down round the table and negotiate what they look like.
Chris, can I ask you a question? Because it's something that comes up often, I imagine, in the UK as well, but from our listeners, a regular theme, particularly John from Los Poliches, along the lines of they, meaning... in this particular case, say Germany or France, they sell us more cars, is often given the example. They sell more to us than we sell to them. Therefore, the car manufacturers, in the case that often comes up, are going to go to Angela Merkel or to François Hollande and say, you cannot impose trade tariffs in this sector on the UK, because otherwise they'll do the same and we won't be able to sell our cars as effectively in the UK. What do you say to that?
Well, that's not my concern. My concern is that the deal we would have to strike, because we have to get all 27 countries to agree to it, would be one whereby we would have to accept free movement of labour, we would have to pay into the European pot, and on top of that, we would have to accept all the rules and regulations that affect the single market without being able to sit round the table and determine them. So I don't see, even according to the Brexiteers' campaign, that we would have gained anything. What we would have lost is influence.
So there's two important points.
So Robert Oxley, just briefly, so Norway and Switzerland, two cases in point here, they do that in different ways. Norway's a couple of deals, if you like. Switzerland is hundreds of them. But effectively, I think if the UK left per capita, they'd pay 17% less. So there are all sorts of figures
there. Both misleading figures. So let's start off with the Norway option. Not that it's an option that I'm advocating. As I said, I believe a British deal, given the fifth largest economy, given that there's a free trade zone from Iceland all the way down to Turkey, that we could be part of that. But in terms of Norway, Norway accepts 17% of the rules that come out of the EU, not 100%. And you know what? Importantly, for British firms, only 5% of British firms actually export into the EU. So if we voted to leave, and if we said, you know what, we're going to continue to trade with Europe because of the incentives on both both sides, whether it's the Germans selling us our cars or the French selling us the wine, the fact that, you know, the incentives on both sides mean that when you go into that negotiation, both sides would want to strike a deal. But importantly, when you look at the actual regulations that are coming, they tend to come more from world bodies in some ways, the most important ones. And actually, those countries which Chris says are terrible, well, actually, they don't have to accept all the rules. And in terms of the budget contribution, you mentioned that, the per capita figure is deeply misleading because it's not actually a budget contribution, it's a specific grant. So Norway pays into developed markets in, say, Eastern Europe. It doesn't pay into the EU budget.
So you're saying that's I've heard that before. So you're saying that's voluntary. When they pay towards particularly, say, Eastern Europe, they're paying for the development aid from Europe.
Yes, they do not pay into to get access to the single market. It's a repeated myth that gets repeated, like campaigners like Chris, saying that Norway...
Chris Bryant, so what Norway pays in has nothing to do with access to EU markets.
Sorry, Chris? I didn't quite hear that, because Robert...
So we're hearing from Robert Oxley that what Norway pays is, in fact, to help develop poorer regions of the European Union, and it's nothing to do with access to the markets.
That was the deal that they struck, so that's still what they have
they
to do. It's not voluntary. So we would still end up paying, is the point. So those who say we would suddenly be able to chuck lots of money at the NHS are telling a gross fib, in actual fact. And there's another point here, which is that if you look from outside the European continent, if you look from China or Russia or elsewhere, there are two things that matter. First of all, if you want to do business, you want to do business in one single large market. If we're outside that, they will simply say, forget about the United Kingdom. And secondly, there's the issue of international clout. And so for the Russians, I think it's particularly important, with President Putin in charge, that you have a strong Europe working together, yes, developing foreign policy together, to make sure that that Russia doesn't do more of what it's done in the Ukraine and elsewhere. That's the only way that we're able to amplify our voice. And I would say, I know some people have been suggesting that we keep on losing battles in Europe. Actually, we win 96% of all the contested votes in the European Union.
The only reason we win any of those votes is when we actually don't object. Every time that Britain
has objected
to a vote in the European Council, it has lost that vote.
96% of the time we've won the battle. Why would we want to step away and not be part of the debate?
Blair's own advisers has actually gone on record. Tony Blair, somebody who I know you're a big fan of, has actually said, we used to vote for things even if we disagreed with them because we didn't want to be seen to be put out. So that figure is totally wrong. Not for me, sir.
No, it's
your
not.
Your own side admits...
You're just fibbing
their
now.
Well, no, it's a direct quote from one of Tony Blair's advisors. One of the guys you actually had in the commission sitting around the council, he admitted that they had to vote for things that they objected to because, frankly, they didn't want to.
Surely being a member of any club, whether it's the World Trade Organization, NATO, or the United Nations, Security Council itself, and the General Assembly, surely you don't always get your way, Robert Oxley.
You're absolutely right. You don't always get your own way. But there has to be a question of when your voice is represented. And we are increasingly outvoted. There is now, with the changes, and I think this is an important point, it's not like the EU is staying the same. It's going to change. And the Eurozone has an inbuilt majority. And the Eurozone has different interests to us. The Eurozone has to reform. It has to sort out things. As as Chris has said in the past, issues such as Greece and Italy, who he suggested basically the only problem in the Eurozone was that they lied. Well, I think it's more fundamental than that, that they actually have to... Basically, Greece lied about its finances and Italy is probably still lying about its finances. That's a direct quote from you, Chris.
I mean, David Cameron negotiated, of course, that Britain would be exempt from ever closer union. Among other things, of course, the sterling or the non-euro parts of the European Union would not be subject to bailouts or to pressures from that area. So surely the UK has the best of both worlds in that sense.
Well, but if you look at the path that the EU is going down, it's envisaged by this thing called the Five Presidents Report. It envisages stuff like a Eurozone Treasury. It envisages taking common positions at international bodies such as the IMF. So, you know, we no longer would get to set our actual position at the IMF. We'd have to toe the EU line. Those kind of things are what's going to happen if we vote to remain. If we vote
to remain, it's more powerful
Brussels.
I just look at the biggest challenges that we as a country, and for that matter, Europe faces. Climate change, the strength of China, the military threats from Russia, international terrorism and crime. In all of those instances, we are far, far stronger if we work in unison as part of the team within the European Union. And you cannot simply pretend that Britain is a piece of Tupperware and you can put the lid on it and close it off and go back to the 1950s.
One second, Chris. Just a few days ago in Switzerland, one of the alleged attackers in Cologne in Germany on New Year's Eve was arrested and is due to be extradited from Switzerland to Germany under the European arrest warrant. Now, I was slightly confused when I heard that, because voices I've been hearing from Theresa May to others suggesting that the European arrest warrant is sine qua non linked to the European Union, but clearly it isn't. So we don't...
Before the European arrest warrant, there was a predecessor. It didn't apply to lots of countries in Europe, and we had to settle individual extradition agreements. That's why, for instance, the Costa del crime used to exist, because we weren't able to extradite people from Franco Spain.
But I've given you an example of Switzerland.
Since Spain's joined the European Union, and we're all signed up to the European arrest warrant. But listen, I mean, you know, Nigel Farage and that lot, they all want us to leave the European arrest warrant even if we're not in the European Union. They still want us out of it.
She wants Britain to leave the European Convention on Human Rights, I understand.
Theresa May wants us to leave the European Convention on Human Rights, that's right. I think that's impossible whilst you stay within the European Union. But Nigel Farage wants us to leave the European Union and leave the European arrest warrant.
The Remain campaign have got a problem here, is that they keep imagining that if we vote to leave, that somehow all international cooperation stops. You know, that suddenly, you know, we'd just be cut off. That is not the case. In fact, what I think, in some of those issues that Chris was talking about, you know, combating international terrorism, for example, the EU as an institution is incredibly bad at it.
So would you stay in the European arrest warrant?
As I said, well, you only have to look
Would you stay in the case in Gambia?
Chris,
answer a straight question. Would you stay in the European arrest warrant?
The joy is that I am not an elected member like you, so I don't...
No, but you're putting the case...
Decision.
So just
I'm
answer
putting,
a straight question. Would you stay in the European arrest warrant?
I'm putting the case that if the British public want to stay in the European arrest warrant while leaving the EU, because as we have pointed out...
But what do you want to do?
Other countries have that too. I want a situation, Chris, where decisions about our long-term security, economics, and...
Just answer a straight question. Stay in the European arrest warrant or leave?
British politicians. And
you can't answer a single straight question.
Chris, come on, you're being silly now. Look,
no, it's a very simple question. You're arguing that we're safer staying, leaving the European Union. Just tell the British public, are you in favour of staying in the European arrest warrant or not?
I think we absolutely would continue to have the kind of bilateral deals which allow us to extradite people. Now, the European arrest warrant, as many people point, have big, big flaws in terms of justice.
Robert Oxley, that sounds like a definite maybe.
I think that we should have a system where we can absolutely extradite. Is the European arrest warrant a good system? Is the European arrest warrant a very good system? Well, there'll be lots of people in terms of a number of British citizens who have been subject to great miscarriages of justice. Who will suggest it's bad to you. My thing is, I think that ultimately decisions about our borders should be made by politicians that we elect.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. And also, Chris Bryant, I think it's from your line. I can hear in the background a bell, which must be calling you into the chamber, because Prime Minister's question time is...
It will be in a moment.
It will be. So very much appreciate you spending your last few minutes of freedom, certainly this morning, with us. Chris Bryant, the Shadow Leader of the House of Commons, speaking to us from the Palace of Westminster, and Robert Oxley from Vote Leave. Thank you, both of you, for joining us here on Talk Radio Europe. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Britain Designs. You're listening to Britain Decides, the EU referendum debate on TRE.
Well, we haven't got much time, but we can squeeze in a couple of calls. Remember, to have your say, call us on 952 78 4000. And a reminder of what is said at the top of the hour, that we're going to be having a Britain Decides Extra tomorrow. So it'll just be just us on our Todd, you and me, and we can have a chat about the ins and outs together. Well, we're joined now by Graham on the line. Good afternoon, Graham.
Hi, Graham from Meath. Recently, I think it was the beginning of the month, someone made the phone companies stop charging roaming charges in the European community. If we go out of the European community, will this be rescinded?
Okay, thanks for that question. I mean, I suppose the answer to that is that nobody knows, as Nathan Thomas would say. It's due to come in June or July of next year. They keep putting it back, but roaming charges to end. And that is a deal that the big telecoms companies have struck with the European Union. In fact, it was forced upon them, basically. And so I suppose they would be exempt from that if they left. Thanks for that, Graham. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Stephen.
What's your point?
My point is, I think that we should stay in the European Union, basically because I think Britain should wake up to the fact that there is global realisation is here. Common sense says we should stay in. Listening to your last two speakers, they are absolutely typical of all of the stuff that comes out of the media, leaving everybody completely confused as to whether they should actually vote in or out. We actually got nothing out of that at all. In fact, yesterday on Viewpoint, there was a gentleman that called in that had put together a really nice poem that actually summons up everything that has been spoken about. And even the guys...
I heard it.
Yeah, and even the guys on Viewpoint didn't know what his view was, which was actually what the poem was all about. It was meant to put that across. And we don't know what it's about. But from my point of view, I just think that Britain could learn an awful lot by staying in the European Union, working with them to improve things. And again, even this morning on the BBC News, they were interviewing fishermen up in Grimsby. And even the guy there said, well, you know, The arrangements used to be bad. They weren't very good, but they have improved, and they keep improving, and that's what we should be working on.
Would you concede that there are pros and cons on both sides of this?
Well, I think I wouldn't consider there's pros and cons on both sides, because actually leaving, nobody knows what will happen. I mean, you know, Stephen, I've been in business for many, many years. I'm retired now. People talk about legislation in Europe preventing them from exporting. I've exported all over the world, including India, China, and Japan. I've never had a problem with the EU. And in fact,
John, sorry to cut you off, but we are actually out of time. But by all means, we can speak tomorrow. The programme tomorrow will be just you and me and, of course, everybody else. Thanks, John, for your call. We're out of time, as I say. Many thanks to Dr. Maurice Pieper, lecturer in international relations at the University of Salford, Chris Bryant, shadow leader of the House of Commons for Labour, Robert Oxley, who's the head of media for Vote Leave. This programme will repeat tonight at 6 p.m. Next week, it's all about you on Wednesday, the 11th of May. We'll be concentrating on the consequences for expats and more focused on the issues that affect us directly. What a Brexit could mean for British citizens living and working in Spain and elsewhere in the EU. And if you're not British, what it might mean for you if you decide to live in the UK. So that's pensions, healthcare, jobs, and whatever else you decide to throw at me. Remember, you can go to our forum and post a comment at talkradioeurope.com. Rob Humphreys was co-producing in Marbella. That's all for today. Speak to you tomorrow.
Britain Bye-bye. Decides.